Thanks, Larry, and thanks to the session organizers for the invitation to talk about some of our work on tile drainage and nutrient management. For those that were watching or were in, heard the first presentation about the Cedar River and the work going on there. I think this fits fairly well with that and maybe goes into a little bit more detail on the performance of some of the practices that are they're working to implement in the Cedar River Basin in Iowa. Kind of the situation in Iowa, and as we'll talk about across a lot of the upper Midwest, we have this increasing concern for local and regional waters. We have a demand for ag products despite the low commodity prices. And then states in the Mississippi River Basin, as a result of the 2008 Hypoxia Action Plan, develop nitrogen and reduction strategies for the states, for the 12 states in the river basin. I'm going to talk a little about about Iowa's strategy and some of the levels of implementation of the practices that would be needed. Even more close to home, at least for those of us in Iowa, and I would imagine most people here have heard about it, but in 2015, the Des Moines Water Works supplies it's the largest supplier of water to citizens in Iowa, 500,000, half a million customers. They filed a lawsuit against 10 drainage districts in three counties in northwest Iowa over the discharge of high nitrate levels from those drainage systems. So really put a bullseye even more so on drainage and the issues that we'll talk about. So as we look at kind of further away, again, the Gulf of Mexico, Mike talked about this in the Cedar River, the load reduction goals to try to reduce the size of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico to that 5,000 square kilometers, or the black line shown on there, is to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loads down the river by 45%. As a state, Iowa has adopted that. That would be our long-term goals, are to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loading, leaving the state of Iowa by 45%. We'll talk about, if we're talking about nitrate, we have to talk about that tile drainage water. So this is a map from Dan James and David James with the National Laboratory for Agriculture and the Environment, ARS lab in Ames on the Iowa State campus, and they developed a map that estimates the percent of cropland that would be benefiting from drainage. And if we start looking at some of the areas, maybe historically in the Red River Valley of the North and in North Dakota and Minnesota, or down in the southern part of the Mississippi River Basin, some of that's going to be surface drainage. But as you look across southern Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, into Michigan, a lot of those areas, we're going to have a high intensity or high percentage of the land that benefits from artificial subsurface drainage. So we've taken soils that were naturally somewhat poorly drained or wetter, and we've installed this subsurface drainage network, and we've improved the drainage of those systems. As you start talking to some individuals, they think this has just happened in the last 20 or 30 years and don't really recognize that drainage really started in the early 1900s in most of these landscapes. So, as we look at those areas, probably some of the most altered landscapes from a hydrologic perspective as we could find. Okay, why is this important if we talk about nitrate? Because if we then were to look at maps that have been generated that estimate nitrogen loss, what we find or what we see is those tend to be in those areas where we have a lot of tile drainage. Now, some would just say, okay, then it's tile drainage that's causing this. Well, not completely, because those are also areas with high intensity of row crop production. As we'll talk about a little bit, that even our non-tiled soils will see leaching of nitrate. But if you combine heavy, int- intensity of annual row crop production with tile drainage, you're going to get a lot of nitrate loss, and that's what we see in the map that Mark David put together in his paper from Journal of Environmental Quality. Okay, so, but we have to recognize there are some yield benefits of drainage, and so, and producers, as we work with producers, that's a common question: what can I expect for drainage benefits? Well, it's going to depend year to year, depending on the conditions you have. But we've been looking at this. I'm going to first talk a little bit about some of our results looking at tile drainage. So we have a study. It's in the southeast part of this of the state of Iowa. We have four treatments. We have no drainage, which those are about 6 acres in size of no drainage, where we actually went in there and cut the drains out, cut the drains. We then have a conventional drainage, which is 4 foot depth, 60 foot spacing. That would be a common depth in Iowa, a 4 foot depth. Then we have a shallower drain spacing, 2.5 foot depth, 40 foot spacing. And then we have the controlled, which again is the same as a conventional drainage, except we have the outlet control structure. For what I would say is the shallow drainage is a passive drainage water management system. Control drainage is an active drainage water management system. These all outlet to a drainage main that has a drainage coefficient, or how much water the hydraulics of the pipe can take away from the system, about 3/4 of an inch a day. Okay, modern design standards would call for about 1/2 inch. We, I guess, designed it a little greater just to try to minimize excess water stress on the crop. One of the interesting things, though, in this from a drainage design standpoint is we tried to have what we call the drainage intensity, or how fast water could get to the drains, match that drainage coefficient of 0.75. What we found is that actually that water gets to the drain a lot faster than the drain can take it away. Probably can't see, but the kind of turquoise circles there, we have a monitoring sump that we're able to look down in, and one of our first big rainfall events, that was filled up with water. What we found is that water could get to the main faster than the main could take it away. That's important as we start talking to farmers about how they design their drainage system, because in this case, we designed it 4 foot depth, 60 foot spacing, but we were getting water to the main faster than it could take it away. If we wanted to make the most economical system for the farmer, when we talk in extension meetings, we say, okay, so what would you have done differently? And the contractors in the room say, I would have put a bigger main in, right? Okay, just make a bigger pipe. Well, they're selling the pipe. 3/4 of an inch per day is plenty good. What I would say, if we were doing it again, we'd make those drains wider apart, maybe 80-foot spacing versus 60-foot spacing. Okay, might make more sense why I talk about that in a second. Okay, so we've looked at for 9 years. I should have said those plots are split in half, so corn and soybean are present in every given year. We split those in half, and over the 9-year period from 07 through 2015, we saw about a 6 bushel per acre increase in our soybean yield. Okay, you can see, you know, some years, 2013, for example, fairly dry year, really no difference in the drainage treatment between the black is conventional, the light gray is shallow, then controlled, then undrained. But look at 09, we see almost a 20 bushel yield benefit on beans, where we have drainage compared to the undrained system. We got about 5 to 6 inches of rain that year in August that just really, really negatively impacted the soybean crop. Okay, if we look at corn, again, we see, you know, in some years very little benefit, but in other years quite a bit more. 09 again, pretty good benefit, whereas 2011, would be one where we really don't see any benefit of the drainage compared to the undrain. But overall, about a 13 bushel per acre increase. Now, when I talk to farmers and I say, 6 bushel on beans and 13 on corn. You know, I'm a little sheepish because, you know, our farmer's going to think that that's a very good benefit. But if you actually look at it, recently looked at, okay, for every year with our yield benefit, so if we got 10 bushel per acre more, and we take into account for that year what the crop price, the USDA crop price was, okay, you can see the annual revenue increase. Now, sure, you'd have a little bit more in hauling costs and all those types of things, hauling a little more grain out of the field, but in general, you know, we're going to put the same fertilizer down, we have the same inputs of seed, so, you know, maybe it's not net revenue, it's just total revenue, and somebody could take into account any other factors. But if we average the corn and bean increase and accumulate that over 9 years, it's about a $560 per acre increase over that 9-year period. Okay? And what I would say is that these yield impacts are likely conservative for two reasons. One is we plant these plots all at the same time. We've not adjusted planting based on the drainage conditions or the soil conditions out there. In reality, we probably could get in and plant those drain plots sooner than the undrained plots. And at least in certain years, there's some indication that we have delayed planting slightly. The other is, even though these are pretty large areas, 6 acres of undrained, in all likelihood, there's a little bit of lateral drainage due to the kind of border tiles on the adjacent drain plot. So it's probably not like an 80 or a 160 acres that's completely undrained. So, but I think this is important, reasonable information for farmers, because what I'd like to say is I'd rather be on the conservative side. So if a farmer makes a decision they want to upgrade their drainage or improve their drainage system, you know, feel pretty confident they could get each yield benefits. Okay, we'll talk some now about kind of the nitrogen loss from our systems and the nutrient management. One of the things I do think is critical, because at least in Iowa and some of the upper Midwest, we just hear all about the tile drainage and the delivery of nitrate from those tile drainage systems. Like our system on the right. Like I said, those are soils with poor natural drainage that we've improved the drainage with that artificial drainage network pipe system, now corrugated plastic pipe. But on the left, our naturally well-drained soil, we may have the same cropping system. It's just that there's no pipe underneath there, but that infiltrating water still will be carrying nitrate with it. Movement to shallow groundwater or through lateral flow to the stream. So we still lose nitrate in those areas. It just may be delivered to the stream in a different fashion. Now we can look at that two ways. One is where we have the subsurface drainage system, at least we know where the nitrate is coming out. And we have some opportunities to intercept that and remove the nitrate. The other, we're a little more challenged to do that, and the practices that we might use might be a little bit more limited. Okay, so if we're going to reach those 45% reduction goals, I should have just had this the first slide when I said what our goals are. We're going to, at least from our assessment in Iowa, and I would say others, science assessments in the upper Midwest, we're going to need nitrogen management, cropping practices or land use, and edge of field practices if we want to reach these goals. We're not going to get there with just one of these. Well, outside of huge land use conversion, if we converted 60 or 70% of Iowa into tall grass prairie, I think we'd reach that 45% reduction goal on nitrate. But that is not a very economically viable solution. So, outside of that, I think we're going to need all of these. And I'll take the rest of the time to try to talk about some of them and the level of implementation we might need. Okay, so when we went through the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy, we tried to look at relevant literature from Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota on the performance of various practices for reducing nitrate or phosphorus. I'm going to talk about nitrate. Reducing nitrate and what it might mean for for corn production as well, or soybean, but really the impacts were on the corn side. So we broke it into nitrogen management, land use, and edge of field. Cover crops kind of straddle that gap, whether it's nitrogen management or land use. But anyway, what you'll see here is that average nitrate reduction on those nitrogen management practices of timing, rate, maybe inhibitor, are all probably in that 10% or less range, with a big standard deviation around that. And if we think about the goal, not a single one of those by itself gets us 45%. If we get into, in this case, winter cereal rye cover crop, we see about a 31% reduction when we average a number of studies. And I'll show a little information from specific studies in a minute. Now, if we look at some of our land use changes, could be very effective in those perennial-based systems, but again, what the economics of that might be a challenge. Extended rotations, where maybe we're getting 2 years of alfalfa in a 3 or 4 year cropping system, can be very effective if we look at that system as a whole. The economics may work fairly well for that on an individual farm scale, but as we think about scaling that up to maybe 4 or 5 million acres of alfalfa in the state of Iowa, all of a sudden the market for alfalfa drops pretty quickly, unless we build more of a market. Okay, and then we have some of our edge of field practices, controlled and shallow drainage, strategically sited wetlands, bioreactors, and buffers and saturated buffers that we'll try to touch on each of those a little bit. Okay, so thought I'd go through a couple pieces of information that I think illustrate the challenges we face with just nitrogen management. It's first looking at how nitrate concentration or loss, the leaching of that varies from year to year. So we have a 25-year record at one of our research stations in north central Iowa from 1990 to 2014, and you can see that each of those years, or each of the circles, is the flow-weighted annual nitrate concentration for that individual year. If we look at that, if we're in a smaller group and a smaller room, I'd ask the question, what's different over that period? Why we see a concentration of 7 in 1993 and a concentration of 22 in 2013? Okay, well, some would say, well, you're managing it differently. No, actually not. This is from the combined corn-soybean system, really the same nitrogen management and early season side dress, first part of June. We're applying 150 to 160 pounds of nitrogen per acre to the corn crop. So just a little above the maximum return to nitrogen for corn following beans in Iowa. So not really at the upper end of the profitable range, so really what we would say, it's not an excess fertilizer system. But what we find is that the drainage varies. 1993, we had 27 inches of drainage from that system. 2012, we had 1. Okay? And so, our loss in general kind of follows that. You know, when we get more drainage, especially with high concentration, we get big losses. If we put it all together, you can see that here. And, as I like to, when I talk to farmers, or really anybody, talk about that 2012 to 2013. How would a farmer how would they manage to minimize or eliminate that spike in nitrate concentration in 2013? Because a lot of that spike came from plots that were in soybeans in 2013 that had been in corn in 2012. So you can't really say, well, the nitrogen management needs to change. Well, the nitrogen management to the preceding corn crop, they're not going to adjust that just because somebody said it might be a drought. In Iowa, Elwin Taylor says it's going to be a drought every year, and he was right once in 18 or 19. But anyway, I think it illustrates the challenge in reaching that, managing that nitrogen. Because in our systems in Iowa, we see almost the same nitrate loss in the corn year as in the soybean year. Okay, we've sometimes heard, well, let's just not apply fertilizer in the fall. We do see at some of the studies in the Midwest, we see some benefit of that. Not all of the fertilizer in Iowa or the Midwest goes on in the fall. In Iowa, maybe 25%, maybe just a little bit more if we include manure. But what we see is that certainly in that corn year, we see some higher nitrate concentrations when we've applied that fertilizer the fall before the corn crop. But then if we follow that system through, then what we see is a lot of years, that following soybean year, we see higher nitrate from the plots where nitrogen was applied fall before the preceding corn crop. This gets really confusing when we talk about, but if we just maybe think of it in general, what we see from our corn-soybean rotation is very little impact of fall versus spring nitrogen application. Now, this is commercial fertilizer when soils are 50 degrees and cooling that we put down in the fall. Some work by Giles Randall and Wasika, they found about a 12% reduction when they moved from fall to spring. And they also found about that 10 to 12% reduction if they used a nitropyrin inhibitor with their fall application versus fall without nitropyrin. We're continuing to look at this timing question. Okay. But nitrogen management does make a difference, and one of the, I think, the big factors is still the rate. As we think about it related to nitrate concentration, we see coming out the tile line. And so the curve that you see there is from our Gilmore City site. The dots that you see there are other data sets from the upper Midwest region that relate nitrate concentration to nitrogen application rate to corn in a corn-soybean rotation. And really that concentration is the combined corn-soybean effect. So if we had individual farms that were, say, at 225 for their nitrogen application, and they came down to the maximum return to nitrogen of 135 or 150, that could be a pretty big reduction in nitrate concentration. But if, as we estimated statewide, that somebody's at about 150, which is about our average rate. If we go from 150 to 135, we don't get much benefit there. We only get about a 9 to 10% reduction. Okay? So it's really important, I think it's really important as we move forward in the future to understand the distribution of nitrogen application rate, because right now all we have are aggregated values. And not everybody's like from Lake Wobegon and right in the average. We got some, you know, some at the ends, and some of those, especially at the upper end, could be having a disproportionate impact on the nitrate. The other thing I think is critical about this graph is where that intercept is. Okay? Will you at least grant me, if nothing else today, that the most aggressive form of nitrogen management would be no nitrogen application? Okay? And even then, we only get about a 40 to 50% nitrate reduction when we look at our systems, okay, which really kind of illustrates we're going to have to go beyond that to things like cover crops. So this is just a slide to kind of illustrate the difference in growth that we could see in cover crops. On the left, you see a site right in central Iowa. On the right is north central Iowa, about 60 miles north of Ames. This picture, or these pictures, were taken on the same date, May 1st of 2015. And you can see the difference in growth that we see. So as we think about cover crops, how we can maximize that growth and uptake of nitrate is critical. And it's probably going to play a big part in, you know, as we think about the variability in performance that we might see out on the landscape, how much growth we get is going to be critical. But if we look at our Gilmore City site, which I'll be the first to acknowledge, we've not gotten the best rye growth year in and year out. We've used winter cereal rye. Until the fall of 2015, we've drilled it in. But still, we've seen there about a 35% reduction in how much nitrate is lost if we look at a five-year period from 11 through the end of 2015. So even in spite of not getting the best growth, we're still getting a pretty substantial nitrate reduction benefit. you can go, Dan James and Tom Casper might be reporting on some data that they get greater than that 35% reduction, but they're closer to Ames, where I think they get better growth of the rye year in and year out. Okay, just a couple slides here to, because we still will get some questions about what's the nitrate leaching under a completely perennial system. I've frequently gotten questions, well, Matt, isn't nitrate leaching just as high under a perennial as it is a corn soybean system? And no, this slide here shows a site results from a site near Ames. Most of this actually was reported in a Journal of Environmental Quality publication that Aaron Day led. But you can see the orange and purple, orange and purple lines are where we have plots of prairie or prairie that's fertilized at 75 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year. This site was one that was continuously cropped until 2008. We put new drains in, and in 8 of the plots we restored prairie. And these are the results that we've seen since then. Doesn't necessarily happen overnight, though. This is from our Gilmore City site where we converted corn, soybean to orchard grass and clover, and you can see how kind of the exponential decrease there. It takes a couple years before we get down to, you know, a couple parts per million. Even in that landscape where we, in this case, we have a drain spacing of 25 feet, so intensely drained system. So as we start thinking about lag times, this kind of information to me is important because this one even took a couple years where that water can quickly make it to the tile, not like a natural landscape where maybe it takes years, in a non-tile landscape where it may take years for that water to get to the stream. Okay, try to get through quickly here. A few of the other practices that we can use as we're thinking about reducing nitrate export to downstream water bodies. We got our subsurface drainage bioreactors. A wood chip trench is primarily what's being used, wood chip for the carbon media right now. For an 80 or 100 acre field, we might have a bioreactor that's 20 foot wide, 100 foot long, 3 foot deep full of wood chips. Okay, that's actually quite a few wood chips if we start thinking about scaling that up. But this is just performance of one of our bioreactors. You know, we're seeing anywhere from 30 to 50% nitrate reduction in these bioreactors, even if we account for the bypass flow. Because one of the things, as we talk to farmers, we're not plugging up their tile, we're not forcing all of that water into the bioreactor. We're really just forcing a portion of it, maybe 10 to 20% of the peak flow into the bioreactor. The rest would bypass so that we aren't having a negative impact on the upstream drainage for the field that's needed for crop production. Another practice that could be at kind of the field scale or at a watershed scale would be our nitrate removal wetlands. This is an example of one of them that's been put in Iowa. The systems in Iowa that have been put in that have been shown to be quite effective are where we're targeting that wetland restoration or creation or enhancement, whatever it may be, kind of at the base of a watershed. So in this case, that watershed area might be 1,000. This might be 1,000 acres. That drainage, surface and subsurface, may surface right there, and we get it into a wetland. And if we have a wetland that's approximately 1% of the contributing area, that may remove about 50% of the nitrate on average. Okay. Now, there may be a couple more percent in a buffer around that area, but that could be planted to native prairie and that kind of thing that might provide some ecosystem service benefit. What's critical is that wetland be sited in the right location, because if we put that same area of wetland right up here, in all likelihood, it won't see a lot of nitrate. Okay, it would reduce the nitrate loss from the land area it takes out of production, but it's not providing disproportionate benefits, and that's where this type of system might. As my colleague, Dr. Crumpton, has monitored, this is the kind of performance that he's seen. The red dots are individual site years for wetlands. What he sees is that those smaller wetlands, in comparison to the contributing area or in wetter years, on a mass removal basis, remove a lower percentage of the nitrate than larger wetlands in drier years. But if you look at kind of the long-term average, if they occupy about 1% of the landscape with the wetland pool, they can reduce the long-term average nitrate load about 50%. Okay? One might ask, is that a pretty good trade? Take a couple percent of the land out of production to remove 50% of the nitrate. Unless you're that landowner, right? And then that might be a little bit more of a challenge. But that landowner is providing benefits. Really, they're providing a watershed scale benefit for everybody upstream by reducing the nitrate export, as well as providing cleaner water for everybody downstream. We've done this on a smaller scale. This again is that site that I showed you, our drainage water management site. So we have about 30 acres and 0.3 acres in a wetland down there that we changed the routing of we flattened the drainage main rather than just running it into the main down there. We flattened it up so it could surface to outlet into the constructed wetland. And we see about probably 30% nitrate reduction for that system. Fairly low cost, though, in this case. Okay, I talked about the drainage water management before, on the crop production, I didn't say too much. We really didn't see any benefit, really no negative of the drainage water management. But we have looked at it from the water quality side as well. And what we found from our controlled and shallow drainage, we're reducing the amount of water that comes out the drainage pipe by about 40 to 50%. Okay. The concentration of the nitrate coming out has really not changed, but if we take that water reduction times concentration not changing, we still get a reduction in the nitrate that's lost, at least from that drainage pipe. Okay, again, about that 40 to 50% nitrate load reduction. Some questions, where does the rest of that water go? There's maybe a few different pathways. Well, I'd say four different pathways. One is we increase ET, but we don't see a crop yield benefit, but there still could be some increased ET. Another could be increase in deep seepage, increase in lateral seepage, or an increase in surface water runoff. I guess that's kind of an area of continued active research to understand the pathway of water loss and then what happens to that water and nitrate before it's delivered to the stream if it's not coming out the drainage system. Okay, just in case folks aren't familiar with this concept of the saturated buffers, this is really Dan James and Tom Eisenhart, and I think some of their grad students are presenting on some of that at the meeting this week. But we put a control structure at the leading edge of that buffer, run a tile line laterally, and try to promote shallow groundwater flow below that buffer to reduce nitrate. So rather than having, in a lot of our drain landscapes, that drain just short-circuiting right through the buffer, we're trying to put something in to try to remove that nitrate and get some benefit of that buffer from a nitrate reduction benefit. And they're seeing about a 30 to 50% nitrate reduction with that type of system as well. Just a couple slides here on maybe what the future might be in tile drainage, and this is part of our transforming drainage project across the upper Midwest. But especially if we get in years with wetter springs, drier summers, we really want to look at, is there any benefit of capturing that drainage water or a portion of that and using that as supplemental irrigation water? And we really have to look at the economics of this system, because certainly it costs in, you know, any type of irrigation system, it may what would cost for any type of reservoir. You might be able to do sub-irrigation, but you still need a reservoir. And you may need to take a few percent, 5% of the land out of production to put this in. So, you know, on good soils in the upper Midwest, what can we expect for yield benefits? And we really don't know. And that's something we're working on trying to do additional research on in the future. But from a drainage standpoint, I think this is an area that we'll see a lot more work on trying to improve our understanding of in the future. Okay, and overall, this system from a water quality standpoint might help us, because we're going to try to, we would be reducing drain flow, because we're going to try to put that water back in, back through the plant. Now, there have already been some people that said, yeah, but if we do this too much and we reduce drain flow too much, we're going to reduce stream flow, and we want the water. We don't want the nitrate, but we want the water. So, but you'd have to do it on a pretty large scale for it to have that big an impact. Okay, the last couple slides, just to kind of illustrate the scale of change that might be needed. I think it's important because, to me, it illustrates, even if we start making changes now, it's going to take a while to reach our goals because of the level of implementation. So in Iowa, for one of our scenarios to reach the goal for non-point source, it takes looking at our nitrogen rate, 60% of all the corn bean and continuous corn acres having a cover crop, 27% of all ag land treated with a wetland, and 60% of all subsurface drained land having a bioreactor. Okay, now those are ands and not ors, and they look big when you look at them that way, but this is when it really hit me, when I look at the number of the millions of acres treated. So, okay, everything, pretty much everything we do, some rate management or nutrient management, nitrogen management. But then we have about 12 million acres where we need to have cover crops. Okay, so 12 million corn soybean acres that need to be treated with cover crops, about 7 million acres treated with wetlands, and 7 million acres treated with bioreactors. If we look at that, that's about 7,600 of those wetlands I talked about before. Not the little ones either, the big ones. Okay, it's about 120,000 of those bioreactors. Just ask the question, how long do you think it might take to site, design, permit, and install 7,600 of those wetlands? A long time, right? Okay. The same with the bioreactors. Okay. And right now we have about 80 of those wetlands, those style of wetlands in place right now. We have about 40 or 50 of the bioreactors. Okay. So we have a long way to go. On cover crop, we have maybe between 400 and 500,000 acres treated with that. So as we look at this, we have a long way to go, right? My last concluding comment on that is, I'm generally a pessimist, but if I could look at this one very pessimistically because of the mountain we have to climb. But I'll look at it optimistically and say, if we're going to do this, okay, I'm not saying who's going to do it, how we're going to pay for it, anything like that. But if society says this is important enough, we're going to invest resources, there's a lot of jobs that could come from putting in 7,600 wetlands or 120,000 bioreactors. We might have to plant some more trees in Iowa to supply those bioreactors. So I think we can look at this, you know, a couple different ways. It's a lot to do. You know, I think about 12 million acres of cover crops. Somebody's probably going to help farmers be able to plant those. You know, as I've talked to farmers, the thought of having to get those cover crops planted in the fall when they're trying to get harvest done and do any other operations, they don't want to have to deal with it. So maybe it's a contract service. So I think that we can look at it and find some opportunities there as well, some small business or rural economic opportunities. So, as we look at it, our infield nitrogen management, I firmly believe we have to start there to reduce nitrate loss and to manage nitrogen both for crop production and nitrate as well as the gas emissions. But to reach the goals for nitrate reduction, we're likely going to need, I'd say more than likely, we're going to need other infield and edge of field practices. And we have to recognize that level of implementation is quite large. I think that's important as we communicate with general public, as we communicate with farmers. It's not just a few farmers making a change, it's really all farmers. And as we talk to citizens, they need to recognize this is going to take some time because the scale of change that's needed. So with that, I've wrapped up and be happy to take a question or two if there's time.
Thanks, Matt. We have a question in from the virtual audience.
Okay. So there's some work going on with tiled organic and tiled conventional that Cindy Cambardella and Dan James are doing in Ames. I'll have to say I'm not involved with that study and I don't have the results. Our department has done work in the past on use of manure, but it was not a completely organic system. So we've used liquid swine manure, we've used poultry manure, we've seen the results of that. It was not, a completely organic system. We did see when we used poultry manure or liquid swine manure that we saw similar nitrate losses from those systems when we had applied similar plant available nitrogen application rates. But unfortunately, I don't. That's a good question. I have to try to see if they have some early results from their study. It's about, I think, about 3 years in on their study. No, because almost, it's really quite consistent across the upper Midwest in what we found. Gary Sands with the shallow drainage has found similar. So at least in the kind of the upper Midwest where we're working with this transforming drainage project from Minnesota into Ohio, we all see similar results as far as not a reduction in the concentration. I know when Wayne Skaggs and Wendell Gilliam started working on this in North Carolina, they expected to see more nitrate concentration reduction than even they expected. So I think we've been going on 9 years and haven't seen a difference at our surf site, and it's somewhat similar with others. But I wonder if some of it is, where some of the organic carbon is for the denitrification, and how that varies from site to site. That'd be something we'll hopefully continue to look at in our transforming drainage project as we have. We're supposed to be working on data synthesis now and start to look a little more in depth to see if there are some sites where we might be able to tease out why some sites see a little bit more than others. Although, as I said, most of ours, we across that region have not seen much.